Welcome to the Paper Player Podcast, where we cover all things pertaining to paper magic. I'm your host, Tony, and I'm joined with my two buddies, Josh and Jeff. How are you guys doing?
Pretty good, man. Pretty good. Been enjoying a lot of the spoilers from the new set. Excited for Magic to get a shakeup.
Did you guys play any weekend Magic?
I was very devastated that Legacy didn't fire, so I did not play any weekend Magic.
That's unfortunate. What about you, Jeff?
Played Modern. I don't know if I'd call it that because I played Blue White and got walked over by all of the discard decks, but it was fun to see Modern. I love that Modern's getting such a big follow. How about you?
I played my Monkey Moonblade and I think I'm finally going to put that deck down. I've had my fun with the deck. I just don't think I can progress it any farther to be competitive. And after watching some of the results that have come out over the couple weeks or the last week for Modern, it seems like just if I'm not playing Mishra's Bauble, I'm losing.
Yeah, the card is very devastating and annoying, especially as a free spell.
I think Metamorphos could probably be in that argument too.
The Metamorphos, I don't mind because it's not free, right? So with Metamorphos, it's only solid if you're playing cards that specifically prowess, where Mishra's Bauble goes into prowess decks, it goes into Delirium deck, it goes into artifact decks. It's a free spell that replaces itself that's also able to combo with cards like Lurrus and Emery. So I struggle with that card in particular because I don't like its combination of what it's doing. Before Dragon Rage Channeler, I thought it was like, okay, this is on the cusp, it's pretty close to being like too good. And now that with Dragon Rage Channeler, it's kind of just pushed beyond.
I think everything you said is absolutely correct, but I also think that to be consistent, I think Metamorphos should go too. I don't think air should be any like free spells that just draw you a card and like filter and whatever.
But Metamorphos can like punish you with the fact that you actually do have to pay to and have it resolve, whereas Mishra's Bauble literally costs you nothing anytime you cast it. It's just free.
For consistency, I still think it's like it's a card that really does nothing, but I feel like it will naturally be the next card once Mishra's Bauble go.
Close. I mean, I would look at it like in the same vein of like Street Wraith, because when Gitaxian Probe initially got banned, I was like, okay, get rid of Bauble and Street Wraith, because at the time the Death Shadow decks were completely dominant and they were just so busted. And I know that Git Probe is a completely different card because it has the ability to tell you if the way is clear or not, so you actually get information. But with how Delirium is starting to become more and more prevalent, that cards like Street Wraith or even Mishra's Bauble just have the ability to just instantly or freely get you card advantage and get Delirium active quickly.
Street Wraith is another one that could go to. It's like another busted, it's free cards or whatever.
Yeah. And with Street Wraith too, it's also hard to interact with just because it's cycling, so it's just going to happen. Mishra's Bauble, I've seen some like some tech like Void Mirror, which is good because it stops all zero mana spells, so I didn't spend mana on it, so, you know, it gets countered and such. Whereas with Void Mirror, does that stop? I think it also, it stops Mishra's Bauble for sure because you spend zero mana on it, correct? Does it stop zero cost spells?
Yes.
Okay. Even though the Mishra's Bauble also did that problem.
Or actually, maybe it doesn't. Because I think it says if mana was spent.
I thought it was colored mana.
Well, right, but if you spend zero mana, you're not spending colored mana, correct? So I wonder, does Void Mirror stomp the Cascade spells? It has to, right? Because that's why.
I think so.
Someone look up Void Mirror.
I'm pretty sure. Because I think that's like tech right now against the Cascade decks. You play Void Mirror, so you're like, nice Shard Lagesse, and whatever you're going to Cascade into just gets countered.
Judge!
Yeah.
Another one, like, decks that play red tend to play that one 2-mana enchantment that they use to stop life, because it also says if no mana is spent to play this spell, that they take 5. So each time you cast Bauble, you're paying 5 life.
Was that Roiling Vortex? Is that what that card's called? Yeah, that card's actually pretty solid. I think you have to spend a red to make them not gain life, but the text just says, like, dome you for 5.
Every upkeep, that player takes a damage, and then whenever a spell is cast and there is no mana spent to cast it, they take 5.
Yeah. So this upcoming week, I think I'm going to try something new, but I'm waiting on cards in the mail, and everything that's supposed to be here in like a few days is clearly taking more than like a few days. From a mail standpoint, I've been waiting on cards for like 2+ weeks. Yeah, it's frustrating, but it's the cheapest way to get it, because a lot of stores that I've been looking for cards at, they have like a copy of a card I want. They don't ever have like 4 ofs, where obviously when you go with the TCG market, I'm just able to get 4 ofs immediately and I know they're going to get shipped to me. They just don't all show up. So there's like a little bit of a delay from like, oh, I want to play this deck, but I have to wait 2 weeks to play it.
The uncommon distribution from Modern Horizons 2 is absolutely atrocious. And I think you can maybe even look at like collector packs and set boosters as like part of the problem, because that's more of the allocation. And those like don't have it. There's like way more rares. They're like packed with rares. And the QC, your box didn't have any uncommons in it.
I had a few, but it, like there were 6 different uncommons I was hunting from the set, and I got 0 of them. And 36 packs, which it sounds unbelievable, and I'm not making this up. Like, I needed Tyler's Provisionaries, I needed the Prismatic Endings, I needed Brainstones, and then whatever the other Dragon Rage Channelers. I got 0. I was like, come on, not one. And usually the reason I used to buy boxes, especially with a set that I really wanted the uncommons from, I would buy a box because it's like, okay, I'm gonna get the uncommons I want. And then I'm going to have gas on top of that, which I can trade all that gas away. Whereas in this set, it was like, I got 0 of it. And the box was, I mean, it's random. So I obviously got a light box just due to not having the amount of uncommons in the box. So I didn't even have chances at those uncommons. It'd be one thing if I had like 9 flame blitzes. I got like 1. And I was like, okay, that's fine, I guess. But I just ended up with not enough.
I forgot I need to get those.
Right.
My deck is going to be so atrocious on Friday.
Which one's flame blitz?
The Planeswalker Killer. It's like a single red for an enchantment. It deals 5 damage to each Planeswalker every turn. Or at the end of turn.
I thought you were talking about the 1 mana, 6 damage or whatever.
He's a common. I got a bunch of those.
I have like, I think I have 2 maybe. Yeah. At plus 2.
I picked the foil ones of those ones just because I saw them for cheap. I was like, yeah, you know what? I'll just get them now. This card ain't going nowhere. The things I want to kind of talk about today are, there's 2 topics, I guess. I want to kind of wrap up the previews of A Forgotten Realm. Mainly I want to focus on the class cards, the dice rolling aspect of the set, and then what we think collectively, what we think the most 5 impactful cards are going to be from an Eternal standpoint. And then I do want to get into a topic that I think people don't really focus on, or at least haven't focused on in the last year and a half since there hasn't been tournaments, but just overall tournament prep. What did you guys ever do? What kind of are your, what are your rituals? What do you do before a tournament? How do you go about choosing a deck, and how do you prepare? So I guess we'll go right into previews. With those previews, we have class cards that came out, which are awesome because I love the thematic of it, or how it like fits from a theme standpoint, where it's basically, it looks like a saga card, but they call them class. And then with the class, it has the level up mechanic or form of level up from, you know, all the way from Rise of Eldrazi, which I think they haven't redone that ability yet. But the fact that these are on enchantments make them harder to interact with. When level up came up all the way back in ROE, or Rise of Eldrazi, it was kind of a mechanic that saw a very fringe standard play, and then you never saw it again just because Doomblaze existed in those formats, or other pieces of removal existed. So just being able to invest all this mana into a creature and then it turned out to be nothing, these being the class aspect of them, or an enchantment card, making them hard to be interactable. So for an example, we have a card called Monk Class. It's blue and a white for an enchantment dash class. When it comes into play, it gains abilities. Gain the next level as a sorcery to add its ability. So it comes in, the second spell you cast each turn costs 1 less to cast. That's level 1, that's the baseline. When you would level up, kind of like in D&D, level 2 is blue and a white to activate. When this class becomes level 2, return up to 1 target non-land permanent to its owner's hand. You can target your stuff, you can target your opponent's stuff. And then level 3, it gets 1 white and a blue. At the beginning of your upkeep, exile the top card of your library for as long as it remains exile. It has, you may cast this card from exile as long as you've cast another spell this turn. So it's thematic to the monk, because the monk is known for like double punching or how what have you in D&D, but it's thematic in that way. But it also gives abilities to the enchantment that interact with some way on the board. What do you guys think of this card? I guess start with you, Jeff.
I think monk class is okay. It's not my favorite out of all the classes. It's not bad. I think it'll be really good in like limited. I think this is more useful in limited than in constructed, but I don't think it's that bad of a card.
Josh, what do you think of like, and do you think any of the, I think there was 12 classes total or 13, I'm not sure what the number is. What do you think, any of them are playable at all outside of limited?
Yes. I want to say I'm extremely excited for the uncommon cycle for my cube purpose. A lot of them do exactly what I want them to do in my cube. So A+, not ballpark out of that. So definitely some cards I'm going to have to pick up. Off the top of my head, looking at them, I remember Ranger class pretty playable. If whoever's got this pulls up Ranger class.
Keep it going.
That's all right. We'll find it eventually. Bam.
Here it is. But The one that makes a... So it costs 2 to play for Ranger class. First class is when Ranger class enters the battlefield, create a 2/2 green wolf creature token. Then to level up to level 2, it costs a green and 1. Whenever you attack, put a 1/1 counter on target attacking creature. And then to hit level 3, it costs a green and 3. You may look at the top card of your library anytime. You may cast creature spells from the top of your library.
And I thought this could be a good card. Especially, like, I don't know if standard... Well, standard's not an eternal format, but, like, this could definitely see play. Even in maybe Pioneer? Like, in a...
An amount of green stompy deck or something.
Right. Even like budget purposes.
Yeah, it's interesting. I wonder how this and these all interact with Veteran Teacher, the card from Rise of Eldrazi, because it puts level counters on it. And are these actual level counters? I'm not.
Doesn't say put a counter, it just says gain the next level.
Interesting. Okay.
I think level creatures and permanents actually say put a level counter. The one I thought that would be playable would be the Paladin class. Like, it's 1 white, and its first ability is dispels your opponent cast during your turn, costs 1 more to cast.
Certainly taxing.
Yeah, that one definitely is.
And then bomb. 3 to go to level 2, and your creatures get +1/+1. Like, so if you want to get aggro, you just level it up.
Yeah.
Paladin class even is, like, that's, like, defense grid for, like, 1 mana. It's a little worse defense grid, but...
I think it's good. That could be playable over defense grid, but defense grid makes them cost 3 more, correct?
2 more.
Sometimes I thought it was 3 more. No, either way, it's really expensive. So out of all the classes, I think they're really interesting. I like that they're exploring more spaces with enchantments other than just like auras. And we've had in the last couple of years, we had sagas, which have been something they want to be a mainstay, especially because they're kind of flavorful in how they go along with like the theme or the story of that set. And then now we have enchantment classes. So if I had to guess, I'm going to say that core sets are going to go away forever. And I think we're going to get a yearly D&D set because they have so much D&D content that they still haven't even scratched.
I don't mind that.
I'd be okay with that.
Yeah. I'm all about that just because core sets in the past have always kind of stunk. I've never liked them. Like, that's what I got. My first pre-release was M10. And I was a new player then, so it was perfect. But outside of that, when I did M11, M12, M13, all the future pre-releases that I've attended for core sets specifically were always kind of boring, and their turnouts were way less than a Ravnica set, an Innistrad set, or even Scars of Mirrodin. Those, I know those have, like, Innistrad was its own set when it first came out, so that was really, gothic horror. That's what people love, that theme. But even, like, Ravnica had, we knew the shocks were coming out that brought people into the game, and on top of cards... like Scars of Mirrodin, thematically, people loved Mirrodin. Not so much the cards that got broken in standard, but the idea of like artifacts ruling the world in that sense.
On the contrary, I've always been a fan of the core set. I don't want to admit to how many pre-releases I've won just with Giant Spider, and I have very fond memories of the core set. I like the flavor of just like, is most of the core set brings back the feeling of old school Magic for me. A lot of it is like vanilla creatures or like very like bland, just evergreen creatures, maybe like just flying and vigilance and first strike. Occasionally you get cards with good ETB effects, but that's about it. And like angels and like dragons, and like I guess the D&D set is a natural evolution of what the core set used to be. So I think that's why I'm very optimistic and hopeful for the a yearly D&D set. I think that's a great idea and a great troll step with what they were doing with the core sets.
Yeah, just the amount of content they have to pull from D&D, they can go on forever. Hell, they hit a lot of like the major marks. But if this set is a hit, which I think it will be, because it's bringing people who love D&D and Magic to definitely buy this set. And then on top of maybe D&D players get into this set.
I think that I don't think they need to convince any D&D players to play Magic. I think this definitely will get more Magic players to play D&D though.
Yeah, for sure. All right. Then there's another set of cards in this set that have dice rolling mechanics. And realistically, the dice rolling mechanic, I think, is going to end up giving people feel bads.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
There's already a large amount of variance like that exists in Magic just with card shuffling, but people don't really notice that. Like, people, they don't equate like the battle, like, it doesn't feel like a coin flip, but when you have a land or a deck with 17 lands and 23 spells, and your opening hand has, you know, two lands and five spells, it goes down to 15, 18, and then a couple spells after that, all of a sudden you're at a 15, 50. So basically draws are like coin flips. A lot of these roll cards are just straight up coin flips. You don't see it that way because they say roll a dice, and I understand. But like, for example, the Aberrant Mind Sorcerer, which has flavor text something, which is not actual, what's the word for it? Oracle text. They gave all these like spells that have like ETB abilities. They gave them like flavor text, but they're not actually like keywords, if you will. So when Aberrant Mind Sorcerer enters the battlefield, choose target instance of sorcery in your graveyard, then roll a d20. And the d20 is 1 through 9. So if you roll a dice and land on 1 through 9, you may put that card on top of your library, and then 10 through 20, put that card into your hand. So I think it's a, is it 45%, 55% on that card specifically? Because you have 11, or you have, is it 10 and 10? No, it's 9 and 11, right?
Yes.
Okay, so it's 9 and 11. So you have 9 rolls at, or 9 hits on this and 11 hits on this. So 45, 55. So that's basically a coin flip. So I think we're not going to be able to, I think people are going to get really frustrated. And the amount of times that someone either loses a game to somebody hitting a crit, which is a 20, because some cards specifically say, if you hit a 20, do something like a little bit more epic or kind of out of control. Or there's even cards that, you know, you roll and you hit a one, which are misses in D&D or critical or failures, if you will.
You drop that your weapon a lot of the time.
Yeah. Something along those lines that people are going to get frustrated by. So this is something I'm sure people are going to see on Arena, but I'm already seeing the post on social media of, I've rolled 300 dice and I've never got a D20. The dice roller on Arena is broken.
I want to know what the dice roller looks like on Arena.
I just think an effect's going to happen. It's not going to actually tell you. Like, you're just going to get an effect and you're just going to have to assume that, oh, I got a 16 because I got this effect.
Some of the dice roll cards are like actually gross to the point though where like I feel like neither of the abilities is bad.
Right.
Like, the better, you always want the better of the two abilities, no matter what.
Agreed. But like some of the like the downside one is draw a card.
Yeah. I mean that's not even a bad effect. If you roll a one, you don't care.
Yeah.
like that's not a big deal. But that it's this if you just look at some of the cards, they're coming to play, flip a coin because it's basically 45, 55, and some of them they're a little bit more extreme. You get outliers such as the critical hit at 20, the critical one, but they don't really get too crazy. A lot of the commons are just like 1 through 9, 10 through 20. These are your effects.
Yeah, some are more broken down, like with multiple, like what is the one, Charizard Chest? It's like 1 through 7 and then 8 through 14.
Yeah. I love these cards, but we're just going to be able to see like the randomness. And the randomness like kind of in your face at like a pre-release because you're going to be rolling dice. And I cannot wait for these discussions of, well, it's already been happening. But if you don't know this, you're going to need a randomized D20 and they're probably going to come in your pre-release kit. Do not use a spin down. I'm not going to allow you to use a spin down. But if you insist on using a spin down, believe me, I plan on the next week perfecting my dice roll to make sure that I'm always 15 through 20.
Oh, hell yeah.
That's because it's not randomized. Like you can definitely set up a D20 and you can roll it in a way or in a fashion where you can always get the top half and not the bottom half. If you can roll it that way and you can consistently get, you know, 14 through 20, you're always going to get the better of the two effects.
Right.
People are like, well, what if both players use it? Well, if one player has, it's like so I played the Pokemon TCG in person and nobody in person uses coin flips. Because you can skillfully always get heads. Because I think the cards say don't call, it doesn't tell you to call it. It tells you if you get heads, do this. So it's really beneficial if you're always able to get heads. In Pokemon, anytime there was a heads or tails, you would roll a dice and odds would be this, evens would be this. Just because the coin flipping aspect of it, you could get good at coin flipping and just consistently always get heads.
Like manipulate it basically. Yeah.
You can skillfully do. Yes.
You can do that.
Yeah. Yes, I especially with the coins provided in the decks, I can grab the Pokemon coins because they're plastic,
right?
And it's so easy. And if you're playing on a playmat, there's no bounce. So if you just get your finger motion where you always hit, like, let's say if I put the heads on my finger and I just flip it, and it lands on a playmat, there's no, like, if it lands on like wood, you're gonna have some bounce variance, right? If it lands on a playmat, there's not a lot of bounce. It kind of just goes, and you can make a small flip,
right? Okay,
there's a way to skillfully do that. And that's why a lot of coin flips, the reason why you when you flip a coin, you call it in the air because the force used is already determined. So you can't really change it while it's in the air, right?
Right.
That's what people say, call it in the air, because there are, if you just say, like, call heads, well, let's say if I was a professional coin flipper, well, you called heads, I'll make go tails this time.
Right.
All right. So the last thing that we wanted to talk about is kind of the top five cards we think are going to be great in this set, and or the most impactful, or have a chance to be impactful. And I think we kind of collected a good list, but I think we should start with the biggest banger, and this is probably the Demi Lich. And that is a quad blue card. It's a 4/3. And then it has the ability for every instant or sorcery that you play, its blue mana cost gets reduced by one. So if you played four instants or sorceries in a turn, it goes from four mana or four blue. If you play one instant, it goes from three blue or instants or sorcery, two, then one, zero. So if you cast four spells in turn, which is really easy with cards like Metamorphose or things along that way, you can do that. And it also has another ability that you can cast that card from your graveyard by exiling four instants or sorceries in addition to its cost. So if you'd like to cast it from your graveyard, any of the ones that you self-milled or anything like that, you would exile, or let's, I will call it Dell, four instance of sorceries. Remove those cards, and now you have the ability to do that. So if you casted four instance of sorceries and you had Demi Lich in your graveyard and one in your hand, you get to cast one from your hand for free, remove those four instance of sorceries you played, and then get this one out. And they're just 4/3s. They don't have any flying or any ability like that, but there's going to be a lot of double Demi Liches or triple Demi Liches plays, and it feels like art like Phoenix, but I think it's better because even if with this card cast like two spells, it now only costs two blue. So it's not too, like, it does get cheaper, and the more degenerate the format is, it's going to get better. So Josh, do you think this card has a chance to see play in Legacy?
Probably. I mean, even in, like, I could probably this card's very, very obviously can find a home in Legacy where you're playing a bunch of blue one mana instants every turn, and you have a lot of options to, like, stock your graveyard and stuff. I have no idea what the correct build on how to build this card is. I just know that free cards are bad.
Jeff, I know you play a lot of Arc Like Phoenix in Historic. What about this, and maybe does this give the oomph to have Arc Like Phoenix exist again in Modern?
I want to say yes really bad because I loved playing that deck in Modern, but like you said, this is way easier to cast than Arclight Phoenix, so like I don't even think you need Arclight Phoenix. Like this with Stormwing Entity, like God, I wish we had Faithless Suiting in Modern still.
Yeah, doesn't this just get busted with Metamorphose?
Exactly, it does. So I think the problem with Arclight Phoenix and why it died is you have no efficient way to get those out of your hands. If this is in your hand and you're still casting a lot of spells, they're essentially free still.
I think you just build mono blue.
Right.
That's no, probably... you want Metamorphose. You're going to need Metamorphose for this card. All right,
so red, blue, and then you just play a bunch of the Phyrexian mana spells like Gutshot and what's the green one? Not Mutagenic. There's the other one where you return a card from your graveyard to the top of your deck.
Yeah, Noxious Revival.
Yeah. You can do so many dumb things with this. Like, it's possible to cast this on turn one with no mana, technically.
With like
four free spells, and this comes down.
Specifically instances of sorceries. I wonder if this will make Thing in the Ice better because
that card was so good.
I always forget about that card.
You can bounce these back with, even if the Thing in the Ice bounces these back to your hand, you can still cast them for zero.
Yeah, I think you build red blue Phoenix and remove the Phoenix part and replace it with this.
Again, the Thought Scours. I mean, maybe even Grixis. Yep. And the only reason I say Grixis is because I like the ability to cast cards like Unearth. Not specifically on this card, but the secondary win condition, like Thing in the Ice, because it's a two mana card. So,
what?
Like,
you honor Thing of the Ice.
You can't target the Demi Lich. Like, usually with those decks, Grixis Phoenix became more of a thing because when the Phoenix part like wasn't going well, you could always go for like an alternate, like Young Pyromancer deck. And then you had like Unearth to bring back the Young Pyromancers.
Right.
All right, this card I think is going to be the most impactful. It could flop, but it just seems like I guess how good is a 4/3 with no abilities is when it's because on the battlefield it's ultimately just a 4/3.
Vengeance. That's a body.
Yeah, but I know it's a dumb comparison. It dies to Bolt, which is being played more now than ever, and Dragon also Chandler, Dragon Channeler, and yep.
This is just blue Vengevine, right?
Close. I mean, you can use this to cast your Vengevines too. Because it's a creature spell when you're casting it.
Do you just like, go green, blue?
I was concocting decks in my head with this card specifically with like Thought Scour and even Hedron Crab and just like self-milling and then doing like a big play where all of a sudden you just cast, you know.
You're just dredge Demi Liches.
I mean, it could be like self-dredge.
What if you do ramp into Demi Liches and Vengevines?
You need your ramp to all be creatures and then like the only thing is like the Vengevines don't do anything without the Demi Liches and the Demi Liches are not fueled really well with like Vengevine.
Yeah.
So it's like is it possible? Probably not.
Pipe dream.
Yeah. All right. What was the next card we wanted to talk about? I don't remember. I forgot. I was so caught up on this card.
I do believe it was the Blue Dragon.
Sure. All right. Josh, I'll have you kind of read that guy.
We got Imrith, Desert Doom, Legendary Creature Dragon, 5/5 Flying. Imrith Desert Doom has Ward 4 as long as it's untapped. And when Imrith deals combat damage to a player, draw a card. Then if you have fewer than 3 cards in your hand, you draw cards equal to the difference. So immediately off the top of my head, did I say its mana cost is 3 and blue, 5 mana?
Yeah.
Immediately off the top of my head, I get comparisons to Dragon Lord Ojutai. And that card was a house in when it was around. I think this is definitely C play in standard and even historic right away.
Jeff, what do you think?
I think it's good. I agree that it'll see play in standard and historic, but I don't think it sees play in anything outside of that. Maybe like EDH, but the draw ability seems really good and the ward is really good, but
it could pair really well with Teferi in modern. I mean, some like you want to go to FNM with your dragon Teferi deck, you could probably steal some wins.
Yeah. I like that this card draws a card no matter what, and then it can when you're hellbent, it can be an ancestral recall.
Right.
This card's pretty sweet. It's gonna when Throne of Eldraine rotates out, it'll probably do some serious work and we'll finally see probably Goldspan Dragons on this side by side.
Right.
Yeah, this thing swings and then you just bounce it with Brazen Bower.
Again, the whole everything until Throne of Eldraine rotates out, everything's just gonna be like horribly shadowed. All right, what we got for the next card? We got 3 more guys.
Treasure Vault. It's an artifact. Nice. Artifact land comes into play untapped. Tap, add a colorless. XX tap, sacrifice Treasure Vault, create X treasure tokens. And this just seems like something that goes really well with Urza Sagas and all those decks in Modern. And it's an artifact land, so I think it goes great in the artifact deck because it comes into play untapped on top of it, which they have, currently one that does that?
Yeah, I think it's just Darksteel Citadel, and then, yeah, that's it. All the other ones either come into play tapped or you have to activate to make them artifact creatures, such as Blink Maw and Ink Moth.
This is the card I want, a stack of from the set. This goes in every EDH deck ever.
You think so?
I mean, why not?
Well, it's because it's 2 mana initially to make a Lotus Petal and a land. It's not just make Lotus Petals, it's sack it. So you can't just do this forever.
I mean, in EDH, when you have 8 mana, you get four more?
No, you get 3 because you're losing a land.
And you lose a land.
Well, whatever. You have 9 mana, you get... Or you have 9 lands, you get 8 or 4 treasure tokens and...
Yeah.
Do something stupid. You can do stupid stuff with treasure tokens in EDH. So
no, I think... agreed. I don't know if it's every deck. I don't actually think I'd play this in mono black or something like that. I think it goes in mono white because they don't have ramp. I think it goes in mono green because they do ramp. I think I guess maybe red plays this, but yeah, I think black and blue don't really care about this card in EDH.
Pioneer finally gets a second artifact land.
This is also true.
They had Darksteel Citadel, and then now they have 2 targets for their Ensoul Artifact, or whatever is that the card?
Or yeah, Ensoul Artifact, the blue and one, it becomes a 5/5 flyer, right?
Mm-hmm.
I have to eat shoe for Pioneer firing and Legacy not firing, I feel.
That's okay. I think people are just, Legacy is not interesting right now, and I don't mean
right.
Everybody wants to play Modern because it's the new hotness.
Right, I want to play Modern now. I was mad that my stuff wasn't here and I couldn't play. So
yeah.
To be fair, every time we've been going over these cards currently, I keep forgetting that Pioneer is getting these cards because I forget that's a format.
Yeah.
So, right.
I wonder if this will see play. And I'm curious to see, I mean, for me, is there I guess the Assembly Worker, is that the card? The one that if you make a treasure, you get to make the other two as well.
Yeah.
That's probably where this card goes.
I need more of those.
And we also got the red one in this set that costs three, that whenever you make a treasure, you make an additional one.
I think they've given up on, well, I shouldn't say they've given up, but they've definitely gone away from doubling effects. The last one we had was a sorcery that existed in Strixhaven, which gave, you know, something you double its power X times. It was green green XXX. I think it's green green XX. So you double it the first time, and then, you know, if you six mana doubles twice, eight mana doubles three times. So they've kind of gone away from at least token effects that have doubled, because like historically in the past they used to always just double, and now they always just like, if you're going to make this many, do one additional one instead.
I think that's smart.
I think so too. Just because doubling is it's not confusing. It's just kind of, it's messy.
Yep.
Well, and you end up with situations like, I mean, granted, this card was beyond busted, but Wilderness Reclamation, like with doubling mana and stuff like that, and you just end up with degenerate stuff.
I take that back. I forgot Vorinclex doubles and also divides. Never mind. They're not going away from it.
I think Vorinclex is like a special, like, or a unique case, though.
That's also like Marrow's favorite thing is doubling things. So I don't think doubling's going anywhere.
Yeah, maybe they're just putting on like, they probably just want big spells to double, where, and then the cheaper spells
not going to get busted in formats outside of EDH. All
right. So the other card is Inferno of the Star Mounts, which is four red red. It's a legendary dragon. This spell can't be countered, so it's already great right there. It's got flying and haste, so you know it's coming down, just do beats. And then it's got fire breathing. And then on top of its fire breathing, it has text that says, when this power becomes 20 this way, it deals 20 damage to any target. Okay, so this card, I know we were talking a little bit before, like pre-cast about this, and you're looking at it to like add a lot of mana. I think there's ways to do this specifically that are like doubling effects, such as like Berserk. Not to say that that's great, but just the final activation has to go from 19 to 20. If it's already at 20 and you activate this, because it's when it becomes 20, right?
Yeah, it's when its power becomes 20. So you have to make 19 to 20.
Okay. So,
it's from math.
So from a doubling standpoint, you could do this with Berserk, but that only exists in Legacy, and this is clearly not going to be good enough for Legacy. So where is it good, and is there maybe...
It's pretty good with all those treasure tokens.
Well, with all the treasure tokens, it is good. I'm thinking, like, does Xenagos EDH play this?
Go ask.
I didn't even think about that. Yeah, probably.
You can pull it, like, for free, and then... Well, you can actually stack it where you're like, pump, 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 double it, and then pump it, like, the remaining time. So you don't need to invest that much. So... what is it, 6? So you just need to bring it to 9, so you pump it 3 times to 18, so you need to pump it 5 times with the Xenagos, and you can do 20. I know an EDH of 40 life, so it's much more difficult. EDH is a combat damage when you deal with your guy, right? It's gotta be combat damage, right? It can't just be 20 damage flat. Okay.
Right,
some reason I thought it was flat. I was like, man, why is this one short of just killing
What you do is you pump it to 20 or 21 in EDH, you smack someone with it, and you deal the 20 damage to someone else, so you're almost taking out two players.
Yeah, it's pretty close.
It still seems bad in EDH, because it just seems so slow.
It is slow. I mean, from a competitive standpoint, but this card's probably fun, and this card's gonna probably see play in Standard if counterspells make a comeback at all from Throne of Eldraine, but I don't think it's
just a 6/6 fire with haste that can't be countered.
In EDH, it's a two-card combo with Dock's Eye Extortionist. You just win the game. You kill two people.
Dock's Eye is completely crazy. What the hell?
Wait, how do you kill two people with Dock's Eye?
It makes like a million mana. That's what he's saying.
Oh, I get what you're saying, yeah.
Dock's Eye is... Man, that card was a little bit of a design fail. It shouldn't have counted enchantments. I don't know why it looks at enchantments.
Yeah, that's what... It's so crazy that it counts.
Does Red ever care about enchantments? Ever?
Never.
Trust me, I've
played Mono Red and EDH a lot, and I've tried to find cards to get rid of enchantments. It's very difficult.
You have like Chaos Warp, and basically that's it.
Yep.
You gotta play Meteor Golem.
I always play, what is it, Spine of Ishmaw.
Yeah, same thing.
Yeah.
It just has recursion ability.
Yeah.
That comes up never, because you have to have like specifically like...
Yeah, I know.
Welder. Believe me, I've tried to live those dreams, and I like from a deck building standpoint that exists in EDH, but so many different times it's like I put these cards in my deck and they never come together, and it's like, you know what, I'm just gonna do the fast Oracle thing.
It's just easier.
Yeah. What is this, the last card, the Grandmaster of the Flowers, what we want to talk about?
Grandmaster of Flowers costs 2 white-white, legendary planeswalker Bahamut. As long as Grandmaster of Flowers has 7 or more loyalty counters on him, he's a 7/7 dragon god creature with flying and indestructible. +1, target creature without first strike, double strike, or vigilance can't attack or block until your next turn. Also +1, search your library and or graveyard for a card named Monk of the Open Hand, reveal it, and put it into your hand. If you search your library this way, shuffle, and it enters with 3 loyalty. I think this card's sneakily good.
Okay. So, can I, a question with this card. Why couldn't they just say up to 1 target player can't attack or block? Would that have been too strong?
Probably.
You think so?
Probably. I mean,
I think this card would be fair if it just said target creature can't attack or block until your next turn. You're only nulling 1 creature. Like, I don't get the reason they had to stamp on the whole that doesn't have first strike, double strike, or vigilance.
That 3 mana Gideon did that, and that card's really strong. So, like, I don't think you can just... you guys are probably right. The first strike, double strike, and vigilance thing is probably going to come up so, like, not often enough that it's probably going to be about the same thing, but it does feel very, like, a bad design fail or whatever.
I think they did that because of the double striking monk. But, like, you would just search your library. I don't want, like, I'm trying to figure out why it doesn't just say, like, up to 1 creature. Like, yeah. why do you have to target? This is really bizarre to me.
Like, they made it cost 1 more than the 3-drop Gideon, and they made it so, like, you can't just null any creature. Like, it feels like a worse Gideon at that point. I feel like you will win some games with this. Like, there will be those games where you get your monks out, you play them, you block a bunch, and all of a sudden you have a 7/7 who's indestructible. But I feel like a lot of the time this card's just going to sit there and die.
It's not only a 7/7 indestructible, it also can't, like, lose loyalty counters anymore.
Yeah, I mean, unless you were to, like, Vampire Hexmage it, that's, like, about right. It.
Yeah.
But does it become that, or is it when it has 7 or more? Okay. He is. Okay, so it's like the Sarkhan. Well, actually, it's different than Sarkhan. Because Sarkhan, you could...
You're talking about the one where you plus in all your planeswalkers become 5/5 dragons?
Yeah, but they stay planeswalkers or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah, and this one doesn't.
He's no longer a planeswalker, yeah.
Weird. This is a weird card.
That's why I think it's good. It's because if you do get to 7, he's all of a sudden, it's unbeatable.
Yeah, but it's the problem of getting to 7.
Yeah,
true.
That's but, 4 turns.
Right. So is this a consequence of War of the Spark? Because I think like we're seeing planeswalkers just suck for the last 2 years since War of the Spark. Like it's, I feel let me rephrase that. Since Oko, planeswalkers have kind of been like really, really weak, and that might have been a response to War of the Spark because War of the Spark did some serious damage on like constructed formats, whether it be like Narset.
Teferi
everywhere.
Yeah, Narset and Teferi were like the most egregious, right? And then you have like alternate win conditions with like Jace, and then even the 6-mana Ugin and even Karn. Like those cards did a lot of work.
Are there 3-mana Ashiok?
Oh yeah, that too. That card still sees play. So that is brutal. This might just be a design where like, hey, we need to tone these things down because when they are too good, they kind of ruin formats. I mean, it's been a minute since like a planeswalker. Well, Oko did that, but since Oko, I don't think planeswalkers are played anymore. Maybe Narset here and there, but that's like more that feels like on par with power level from like a standard standpoint. I think they're just trying to avoid like Super Friends control to exist.
Right.
All right. That's all. Those are the cards that I think we like the best from this set. Everything looks pretty strong. Let me rephrase that. This set's really flavorful, and I think it's going to be a lot better than your standard core set because the last couple of core sets, there hasn't been any really big bangers other than like the occasional like Veil of Summer or things that are kind of on that power level. I'm trying to think like what came out in M21 that's like actually good in other formats.
Terror of the Peaks.
I guess right. Armwing Entity.
Yeah,
M20.
Stormwind Entity.
Yeah, that was good. M19 both had Field of the Dead and Veil of Summer, and those cards are...
Ruined formats.
they're pretty messed up. The 8-mana Ugin, though, that already existed.
Yeah, that was a reprint. That's yeah. I think core sets normally are just made to, like, fix a format and, like, print stuff into the format to fix it and, like, reprints. That's why I kind of, like, I hope the idea that the D&D sets will be the new core sets, because then there's an actual like story to it. It doesn't feel like I'm just getting a bunch of regurgitated cards like given to me, like, here's your eighth lightning axe you're never gonna play, or here's your eighth rampant growth.
Also, from the arena standpoint, it's a real big feel bad to have four of a card from M19, and then they reprint the card at M20, and then you have to get four copies of that too. They don't like, so you effectively have eight cards that exist, right? But you can only play four of them in any deck, and it's not like a real life collection where if you want to play or have two different decks, you might want to have more copies. So it feels bad to open up like Temple of whatever in M19 and then open it again in M20, and then you don't get like rare slots back. You just have to take those as rares. Like, that feels bad. Whereas this has like all unique cards.
Yeah, I think on Arena I have six different versions of Shock.
Yeah, it stinks.
I still would appreciate like using these as a spot to reprint cards that need to be reprinted.
Oh, agreed, but you don't have to always name them the same thing either, though. Or like print, like functional. Yeah, reprint. Yeah. And like, even looking through this, Plummet is in here, and that card has been printed.
Yeah, that's fair. I did forget about times. That.
But like, that card also fits the theme of like D&D, so like, I don't mind it. It's not just stamped with an M22 on it, and it's the same art I've seen for the last like 8 years.
Yeah. I guess next, we're going to move right along to our next topic, tournament prep. I know I kind of spoke with you guys earlier. You guys aren't really the most ideal tournament prep individuals. The way you guys kind of go about it is really loose. And I guess let me hear kind of your perspective, and I'll go into like how I do a tournament prep. So I guess, Josh, what do you do? Let's say 2 weeks, or let's say 3 weeks from now, you know there's a Star City Games coming and the format is whatever. What do you do to prep for it?
Let me talk about the time that I performed the best. Like, not necessarily how I've prepped every time, because I'm a human, and you go to these events with, you know, four of your best friends, and you end up, you know, four of your best friends. And sometimes four of your best friends aren't always the brightest minds. But the time I did it the best, we drove that day. I stayed home when we drove to Chicago that morning. And that time I got my good night's sleep. I had my new sleeves on my deck. I had my deck list already written, and I just went in well prepared. Everything was my deck. I didn't change anything last minute. I had my deck with new sleeves. That's always a thing I want to do when I'm going in there. I don't want to get DQ'd for some, you know,
art sleeve or something.
Right. The time I did it best, I was 100% prepared when I went in there. The weeks prior to it, I also got a lot of training on MTGO, which was a valuable resource as a paper player that you get more reps in for a big tournament.
Nice. Jeff, would you do something kind of similar to that line?
Somewhat. Normally I do hop on MTGO and try to get reps. I try to go to like every tournament I can, like Friday Night Magic. If there's, you know, the format I'm practicing for on Sunday, I'll go to that and stuff like that. It does change if it's out of state, because out of state we tend to like drive the day before and we get there really late because a lot of us, you know, are working and stuff like that, and it's hard to request off.
Right.
So like, those rituals normally tend to like turn into us staying up late. I try to avoid it nowadays if I can. You know, I'm not 18 anymore and able to run off 4 hours of sleep at a tournament. Yeah. The key thing I always tell people though is eat in the morning. Like, eating is like the most important thing, because if you sit down, you don't know if you're going to get times between rounds. And that's like one ritual and prep I always make sure to do is eat the day of the tournament.
Nice. So I
most important.
Yeah, so I've changed things, obviously, like recently. If I were going to prep for a tournament, I would just strictly do on MTGO. But the way I used to do it is I used to like make events through like Facebook of everybody in the local area. And I would just make like a, hey, the format's modern, SCG is coming to Milwaukee, we're gonna test for this. I'd make a big Facebook group, and I would essentially assign like, these are the decks we need to test. Here are the decks that have been already filled out by these people. These are what they're going to be playing at this testing session, and this is probably what they're going to be locking into the tournament. Bring as much information. And the point of this is to sit down, discuss the matchup, and kind of go a little bit more in depth. MTGO is great, and it's like the way I would do it now, but unfortunately with MTGO, I can't directly communicate with my opponent, because it's probably, if I beat them, they're going to be probably unwilling. And if they beat me, they have no incentive to kind of help me. So one of the things I've done to kind of level up or go beyond like testing is actually sitting down or watching two individuals play, and then after the match discuss, like, hey, why did you sideboard this? Why did you do that? What were the things that were the most powerful? And, like, are you planning for their sideboard? Because a lot of times people do not consider other people's sideboards. And that's, like, one of those metagame things or, like, level up or next level. People don't think about other people's sideboard. Like, for example, like, mono red or different burn decks. They'll play cards like Destructive Revelry or Smash the Smithereens. When I'm playing a Stoneforge, like, Mystic deck, games 2 and 3, I am clearly aware of those cards. A lot of people aren't. They'll just jam their Batterskull down and be like, okay, I got this game locked up, and then they get smashed to smithereens, and that's the game. They weren't really playing around that. So one of those testing things to do is, especially when individuals are picking up new decks, they have the ability to go jam that matchup. And as you're playing, let's say if I was playing Blue-White Stoneforge and Jeff was playing Mono-Red, and I just jam a Batterskull, you could smash the smithereens, and I go, okay, like, don't do that again. And then we can discuss, like, oh, yeah, you are playing these, and then eventually after the matchup, like, okay, how many of these are you bringing in, so how much do I need to be aware of? So MTGO is a great source to just get familiar with the deck, but I think mastering the deck, as long as you're not playing, like, rogue decks, and usually with those testing crews, I say, like, no rogue decks allowed, just because it doesn't benefit anybody but that individual. I'm trying to collectively benefit the group. The best thing is actually hearing the interaction of the other side of the matchup.
Yeah, rogue decks is something you discuss after everyone has gotten a fair amount of playtesting in.
Now, if you want to play a rogue deck, like that Monkey Moonblade deck, if I were to host a testing session, I would not play that. I wouldn't bring that because I would think that would be a big waste of people's time. It would just be like, hey, I'm hosting this testing session so I can get all the information. Because honestly, the amount of times you might play that in the tournament, zero. The amount of times you're going to play Delver right now or Drain Rage Channeler, a huge amount. You should probably get that matchup mastered.
To be fair, Monkey Moon is becoming a deck, just a heads up. I've been seeing it pop up on, like, Twitch a lot lately.
I don't know if it's the variant I'm on, the Stoneblade variant. It's probably just,
yeah, a lot of them are playing Stoneblade. A lot of them are playing the Moons, the Magus, like, all of it is definitely becoming a deck. And I think it's just purely because people are sick of Urza's Saga right now.
Well, I mean, you could see from the challenge, Urza's Saga doesn't really exist. It, like, didn't exist in the challenge. It was basically all Cascade and Delver decks.
Oh, really? I didn't know the challenge finished.
It was the one on July. It happened on 4th of July. And that one, it was like, if you looked at that, there were a few Urza decks, but nowhere near to the volume there were. It could have been because people didn't have Urza Saga, but everybody, I mean, that list was like, I would say like 70% of the decks had Mishra's Bauble in it.
I saw half of it was like Blue Red Delver.
Yeah, that deck is completely dominating.
Chandler is a better Delver, in my opinion.
So with deck choices, do you guys make decisions based on, like, your collection? Because one of the things about, like, the group of people that I've cultivated, I let people borrow my cards, and I definitely, like, I would hope that people would do the same. And I've always been like, hey, like, I'm missing X, Y, and Z, and there's none in the market, and I can't, like, I've made a change to this deck. When you guys lock in a deck, how far in advance are you locking that in? And then are you willing to change decks if you find out that your deck is obsolete?
So it depends on when I find out about the tournament. If it's like a month or two before the tournament, I'll look at the format as a whole, see if it's going to be changing beforehand, like if there's a set coming out beforehand. If there's not, I'll find something that appeals to me. But then I definitely will ask people, like, hey, do you think this deck is viable in the format? So on and so forth. It happened once before. I built Abzan for Modern for a team event, and literally 3 days before the event, Once Upon a Time got banned.
Mm.
And that felt real bad because I literally had no other deck to change to. I didn't know what to play at the time, and the deck was in a bad position without that card at that time too.
Yeah.
But I am willing to change if, like, a deck becomes obsolete and I have the option to change.
I was going to make that comment. Like, what about when the card gets banned 3 days before?
Yeah. Felt real bad after picking up all those fetch lands and shock lands.
Yep. It's definitely, I feel bad for sure.
We had 5-0s with that deck.
Yep.
Oh my god, that was so devastating. That was like before the team trios, right?
It was right before the stay at home order happened, literally like the day before.
Oh, boo. That feels bad.
That was the one you were in, T-Bone, where you were playing Pioneer.
Oh yeah, I do. Yeah, I remember that one. And yeah, I just played Mono Red just because I needed to help my two partners. They were a bunch of dopes.
Welcome to Magic.
JB was one of them.
What about you, Tony? What do you like? Are you willing to switch if a deck is bad? And is your pick on deck based on what you have in your collection?
Usually, I have resources that allow me to get any deck I want at any time, which is pretty nice. But from a testing standpoint, MTGO is like where I'll go if I'm gonna do that. Usually, like for example, like the next week was the modern like SCG, I would plan on playing Delver or some kind of Mishra Bauble variant, and I would want to be able to both have the Delver and Urza Saga matchup covered. So I would look for a deck that would kind of do well against both, but I usually try to just do like lists that I've seen do well and like multiple results. Whereas when you see decks that are like homebrewish, unless you are onto something, and this doesn't exist in the modern age, but I remember there was an SCG in Milwaukee, and one of the local guys, his name's Peter, he was on mono black control, and this is before Pack Rat and Gray Merchant was like discovered. And I think I was on like a green white list, and I just remember seeing the deck in like round two or three, making fun of it because I was like, "What is this? Like the worst deck I've ever seen." And just he top eight it. He smashed the tournament. It was nowhere near the optimal list. It was playing like Liliana of the Dark Realms, but he was onto a secret. He was onto something before everybody else was. That doesn't really exist in this day and age, especially because this stuff comes out way before we get the chance to like actually get it in our hands. So
it's all on the internet before it even comes out in paper.
Yeah, I mean, if there's a combo with a card, everybody's already figured it out, like within hours. They're like, oh, here's the infinite combo right here. Boom.
Nowadays, it's hard to like surprise people with a deck that's going to like take a tournament because like you can only build your deck to combat so many decks before you get crushed by the other decks and so on and so forth.
Yeah, I think you can handle like an FNM level, but I do not like a 4-round, 5-round tournament. You can kind of sneak some 4-0s, 5-0s there from like a local standpoint. But at like an SCG where it's 9 and then even day 2, the likelihood of you getting away with something that is like unknown to people is just, it's too high. It's just no way. I mean, you'd have to keep it under wraps. And if you're keeping it under wraps, how are you getting it tested? And then if you're testing, who's testing with you? And then how is that person just not being like, you know what? I'm not testing against this junk deck. Like, I'm not doing this, you know?
I miss the days of being able to show up with rogue decks and surprise people. I've seen it happen a couple times where like decks have turned into like things because of that. A friend of mine, Antonio, had built what was that, Rally of the Ancestors when that card first came out. He built a deck with that, and like 2 or 3 weeks after he played it at a couple FNMs, the deck started popping up like 5-0 lists online.
Yep.
But you can't do that anymore because, like you said, right away, as soon as a card's spoiled, the first thing people do is look for combos with it. And that way, when it comes out, they're already spoiled. There is no, like, surprise anymore when it comes to, like, metas and constructed formats, I feel.
Yeah. During the tournament, is there anything that you guys try to, like, particularly do to make sure that you're, like, keeping pace? Or, like, I know you mentioned, like, eating, which is really important even before, but even during. But, like, how do you guys handle a loss? Because usually at these types of things, it's real tight. You're allowed to drop like a game or a match.
Depends. Like one thing I make sure to do between matches is I always bring a bunch of water with me because like you dehydrate and stuff. But I'm not condoning this, but I am a cigarette smoker. So if I lose a match, I tend to go outside, have a cigarette, and kind of like go over like why I lost, if there was any play mistakes I made, what I could do better next time. I try not to beat myself up. Obviously, it does happen. Sometimes you get tilted. It's a part of playing any competitive game. But like mainly I just try to like look at it as in like, did I make a play mistake? If I didn't, what do I do to beat this next time? What can I do to change to beat this next time? Or what should I look for in the future?
I think going outside is probably the biggest like help. Like I like to go outside and just talk it out. Like I think the fresh air, like just like a change of atmosphere. I feel like getting out of like, you know, your poor situation and just giving yourself a new, you know, breathing space is definitely beneficial. I find extreme value in just going outside, even if you're not smoking, and just talking it out.
Yeah, I tend to get really quiet, and this is something I've like tried to work on more and more. And especially so I used to have like a real issue with like not like if I didn't respect you as a player, I just thought I should always win, which this game is high variance, and the more I play it, obviously the more I'm going to learn about that. But I mean, there were matchups where I thought I was favored if I was like a heavy favorite. And then when you would lose those matchups, especially when they're in crucial spots to get to like top 8 or top 16, I would just fall silent. I never like went after or like yelled at my opponent or anything like that. I just became silent, but I would like dwell on it. And one of the things I've kind of learned to do is just like understand that when you take those losses, absorb what happened. Like I'll replay the match maybe one time, twice in like my head, maybe like do what you guys do. I'll even go stand out with smokers. I don't smoke, but I'll just go there just to communicate and bounce thoughts off my head. Like, oh, what right. I could have done. And then come back to the match or come back to the room and try to like just put that in the past. I mean, we've all seen this at tournaments, right? Where individuals, they just spiral. They're like 5-0, they lose one, and they lose one to like a bad beat, and then they just cannot recover, and that just clouts their future of the rest of that tournament.
Right.
One time I top 32 the energy, I literally lost round one to Reanimator playing Burn and Legacy, and went outside and I bounced some ideas off of Josh and some other people, and I came back and I lost my last round of the tournament to not top 8, but it definitely, like, I didn't come back in thinking that every round was going to be the same way. I didn't allow myself to dwell on it. Like, it happened. I got to move on, learn from it, and just keep trying.
Do you guys want to add anything else?
Stay hydrated.
Remember, it's a game and have fun.
Right.
That's true. I think the reason I used to get salty was because at the time I was making a run like the PTs, a lot of the local players around here, for whatever reason, Milwaukee got like really soft on like people going to tournaments. Or let me rephrase that. The people in my game store like all kind of stopped going. I still wanted to go. So I was going by myself a lot. And when you go by yourself, you kind of have like an unrealistic expectation, because it's like if you go by yourself and you lose, it feels, that drive home sucks alone. When you win, you're like on cloud 9, but you're also not communicating with anybody else. Like you're just like enjoying, you know, I guess the takeaway would be always travel with like friends, even if it's just like two people, because then you have an ability to talk to people. That's why I think the team tournaments have always felt the absolute best.
Even if it's a friend you barely know from FNM, like it's a great experience to like, you know, a great opportunity for like you and your friend you made through Magic to bond. And like, even like I went out with Mitch and them to, I had drafted with Mitch a couple times, and I went to Indianapolis with him and stayed in an Airbnb, and it was a great time. So like, sometimes you make new friends that way, and like, just communicate. Like, Magic is about the gathering, right? Your friends are there to help you. Sometimes you win, sometimes you lose. There's got to be a loser in every game. So like,
right. I've even made friends with like opponents before. Like, there's people that followed the NRG series that I would see them in tournaments, and because we had like a really good match and we talked about it, or we had something happen where we had to call a judge and it was memorable. So like, we'll see each other and we'll talk and like say hi. Like, I might not know their name because I don't remember and they don't know mine, but we still bounce ideas off. Just like, hey, I just had this match, what do you think about this? Sometimes it doesn't even have to be a close friend. Like, opponents can be friends too sometimes.
Yeah, for sure. All right, guys, my question of the week is going to be one. I'll start by answering it right away so you guys have some time to think on it. But what is your luckiest moment in Magic? And I want this to be like gameplay related. Don't bring up, like, I know you guys have had, especially Jeff, you've had some serious opening luck lately. And I have too. I've gotten really lucky lately, and that feels good. So I'm going to kind of rewind us back to Shard. Is it Zendikar? Zendikar block. Not block, but I was playing Standard, and at the time I was playing Mythic Bant, and that was the deck that was Noble Hierarch with Sovereign of Lost Alara, and then you get to put the Eldrazi Conscription on. My round 7, and this is like I forget what the size, it might have been a PTQ, but it was going to go for top 8. And I remember playing against Jund. I mulled the 4 in game 3 against Jund. I won that game after he Bloodbraid and Blighting me and bolted my Noble Hierarch on turn 1. I mulled the 4 and got away with that game. He drew, I think, 11 straight lands, and I just happened to draw like a random Quasali Pride Mage to just hit them for like 3 over and over and over. It was like one of the strangest experiences ever, because one, I mulled the 4, and he's playing a discard deck. He's playing Blightning. He did Bloodbraid Blightning me. I was still able to somehow get out of that match. When he finally drew, like, I don't know what his opening hand was, but it had to be Lightning Bolt, Terminate, because he killed my first two plays, and then he did nothing, and then went Bloodbraid. So he must have kept a 4 land with that exact, and I thought I was just like doomed for, because I thought I was just going to lose straight to like a Bloodbraid Elf. I ended up drawing Path to Exile, and then he drew an Ant Queen like 7 turns later, and he had like 15 land, and I was able to exile the Ant Queen, and then somehow be able to draw like a string of lands and Sovereign of Lost Alara to beat him. And like, this is just like, and this is like the old Mulligan rule, where it was like terrible, where it's like you went from 7-6, 6-5, 5-4.
Oh, I don't miss those days.
Nope.
All right, Jeff, you got one for me?
So it was my first energy. I had built mono or red blue Phoenix without Phoenix. It was like literally the weekend like that deck was discovered. I was playing. It was running the Enigma Drake instead of Phoenix. the 3-drop Drake. Anyways, it was round one, and I was playing against Titan, and it was game three. I was at 3, and he played Valakut and needed to play a mountain, so I had literally one turn to, like, do something to stop him, and I ended up ripping the Magus of the Moon off the top and playing it. Turning off the Valakut and proceeding to bash him with I think it was like a 15-4 Drake, the 4-drop one. Mm-hmm. And that was like, I could feel myself shaking drawing the card, because like, it was just like, I didn't want to lose to a land, because losing to a land feels terrible. And it just ripping that Magus, I've never felt so good about being lucky in my life.
Nice. Josh, what do you got?
What came to mind for me was Saturday big CEDH. I was at, so it's $10 a person, winner take all at the final table. It's normally about a $200 credit prize. I remember being at the final table playing competitive Gitrog Monster, which is my CEDH general. The final table is always very cutthroat. It's very hard to win that event. I've only ever done it a handful of times, but I do remember one particular instance where it was maybe turn three-ish. I knew that whoever, I could tell very easily that whoever was going after me was going to win. I remember I was missing the Dakmor Salvage in order to combo. I had the discard outlet and I had the Gitrog on the field, and I was missing the Dakmor Salvage. I remember casting the one that's sacrifice a land, add a color of any mana to your mana pool. Mana enchantment. I remember casting that and sacrificing all my lands. Sacrificing all my land. No, Cadaverous Boom is not the card I'm thinking about. Cadaverous Boom.
Squandered Resources? What the hell is the card?
Squandered Resources.
There you go.
Squandered Resources. Sacrificing. I remember I sacrificed all my lands down to one, and I was like, do I really stay here, or do I sacrifice this one last land to try for it? Sacrifice the last land, hit the Dakmor Salvage, and proceed to combo and win the game.
Especially in a 99 card format, it's gotta feel like just so awesome.
Right.
Nice. All right, guys. I mean, I enjoy hearing those stories. Those are a blast, but I think we're coming up on a long episode for JB to edit. He's going to be known as the edit master from now on, because I edited the last episode and my God, was that a beating.
Right.
All right, guys.
Did we mention JB is sick? Everyone.
Week he was too busy, and then this week he's just sick. He's just not feeling well.
Everyone wish him well.
Yes. As always, you can check us out on Facebook. Please give us a like on there or follow us on our Facebook. You can always follow us on Twitter. I haven't been so active, but go ahead and do that. And feel free to always send up questions at our email at paperplayerpodcast@gmail.com.
Did you check the email?
Let me check it right now.
Yeah, we probably have questions from like 3 weeks ago, man.
Someone talk about the Bucks.
That's what my outro, my outro words. You can't. Do we have an email?
No, we got none. It was all, spam.
Someone send us an email.
Yeah.
One day we will. All right, dudes.
We'll have questions.
Good cast.
Bucks and six.
Bucks and six. Bam. Edit that one, JB, you sucker.